Welcome to today's deep dive. I am your resident curious, book-devouring friend, always looking for a new obsession.
And I'm here to be the insightful voice, hopefully, to help connect all the dots for you today.
You always do.
Yeah.
So let's just unpack this right from the start. Why is it that our natural instinct is always to expect art to be this literal documentarian translation of reality?
Oh, that's such a good question. It's like we demand proof, you know?
Right. We have this implicit expectation, like when you look at a painting or a drawing of a city, that it should basically function like a photograph.
Yeah, exactly.
You expect the light to bounce through a lens and freeze perfectly on a two-dimensional plane, a place where, I don't know, Euclidean geometry and gravity are perfectly respected?
Because we crave a notary's record of the space. Uh-huh. Every single angle checked, every proportion perfectly scaled.
It's very left brain.
It is. And that kind of mathematical literalism gives the human brain an enormous amount of psychological comfort. You look at a traditional architectural rendering and your brain just relaxes.
It really is comforting. Like, we like it when a street has a logical vanishing point. We feel safe when buildings look like they actually obey the laws of physics.
It's clean. It's binary and pure.
Exactly. But today, for you listening, we are looking at a set of notes and technical specifications from an artist who violently rejects that comfort.
Violently is the right word, yeah.
We are diving into an audio analysis of the reflective notes of the artist Jairo Duque, specifically regarding his watercolor painting titled Homes, Guanajuato.
Which is just a fascinating piece of work.
It really is. Our mission today is to unpack how he rejects digital accuracy and literal realism to physically materialize memory, and how emotional saturation can literally distort our perception of physical space.
It's a brilliant case study, really, because that mathematical literalism we just talked about, it shatters completely when we enter the territory of emotional memory and cultural identity.
It just doesn't apply anymore.
Right, because a memory is not a topographic map. Mm. When you try to capture nostalgia, the photographic lens becomes entirely useless.
You're not dealing with geometry at that point.
Exactly. You are dealing with a psychological landscape. So painting, at least in the context of this specific piece, isn't about replicating what the optic nerves capture.
Right.
It's about how you build a memory that you can actually physically touch.
I love that. Building a memory you can touch. And to understand why this painting completely abandons literal realism, we first have to look at the geographical realities of where it was created versus, you know, what it actually depicts.
The physical disconnect is huge here.
Huge. So the technical specs outline this profound friction. The piece was created in January 2023. It measures 11 by 15 inches, and it was exhibited in Switzerland.
But the real kicker is the studio location.
Right. The artist painted this in a studio in Whittier, California.
Which is over 1,000 kilometers away from the actual physical streets and alleyways of Guanajuato, Mexico.
That is a massive distance.
It is. He wasn't setting up an easel in the town square under the midday sun, painting from direct observation. He is completely disconnected from the physical space he is depicting.
So the painting is an act of pure retrospective recovery.
Pure memory.
He's relying entirely on his mind. And here's where it gets really interesting for me. Looking at the materials he chose to execute this memory, he isn't just using standard craft store supplies.
No, the materials are highly specific and deliberate.
The specs detail that he used a 300-gram cold-pressed Arches paper. And for anyone listening who is outside the fine art world, 300-gram paper is thick.
Very thick.
It's dense. It's robust. It's almost like a heavy cardboard. It's designed to take aggressive amounts of water without warping.
Which he definitely needs for his process.
Right. And on top of that paper, he used Daniel Smith watercolors. The notes mention these paints are prone to a process called granulation. So how does that chemical process actually work, and why does it matter so much here?
Well, the choice of Daniel Smith watercolors is basically the key to everything in this piece.
Really?
Yeah, because those specific paints aren't made from synthetic liquid dyes that just sort of stain the paper smoothly. They are manufactured using crushed real minerals.
Like actual rocks.
Actual heavy geological matter. So when you mix those crushed minerals with water and apply them to that highly textured, cold-pressed paper you mentioned, a physical separation occurs.
Okay, I'm visualizing it.
As the water evaporates, the heavy mineral particles physically settle. They sink down into the microscopic valleys of the paper's texture.
So they don't just dry flat on the surface.
Exactly. They leave behind this tactile, sand-like geological texture on the page.
It creates a physical relief. You know, I was trying to think of an analogy for how to picture the emotional weight of this technique.
Okay, let's hear it.
It reminds me of the concept of a weighted blanket. When you are feeling isolated or far away from someone you love, looking at a flat photograph on your phone doesn't really soothe your nervous system.
No, it's too flat, too digital.
Right. You want physical pressure. You want a heavy blanket to simulate the physical mass of an embrace.
Mm-hmm.
Like trying to write a passionate love letter, relying entirely on the muscular memory of the heart.
Oh, that's a beautiful way to put it.
So is the artist using these heavy textured geological minerals to physically compensate for being 1,000 kilometers away from Mexico?
Yeah.
Like literally grounding an abstract memory into a textured reality.
What's fascinating here is that that physical compensation is the entire foundation of the piece. Yes.
Wow.
He is using specific granular pigments to physically transform an abstract memory into a tactile presence. Because a memory is weightless, right?
Yeah.
And distance is incredibly alienating.
Yeah, distance makes things feel less real.
So by utilizing these heavy minerals that settle into the paper, the technique itself dictates a physical presence. The weight of the paint bridges the geographical gap.
So he's essentially building the physical reality of Guanajuato, right there on his desk in California, mineral by mineral.
Exactly, mineral by mineral.
That is so cool. And if the physical weight of the paint anchors the memory, that material choice seems to drive the most aggressive aesthetic choice in the entire painting.
You're talking about the color.
The extreme feverish color, because the color palette here is intense. It's almost blinding ochres, radiating oranges, deep blues. From second one, literal realism is completely thrown out the window.
Totally abandoned.
Why abandon the actual colors of the real town?
Well, he explicitly rejects a descriptive palette. He has zero interest in capturing the exact faded shade of peeling paint on a specific wall in Guanajuato.
Because that's the job of a documentarian.
Exactly. Instead, he saturates the colors to an absolute fever pitch. And those specific colors are deeply tied to the natural pigments historically used in Mexican architecture to establish community identity.
Right. The notes mention pigments like añil and grana cochinilla. What is the significance of those specific materials in this cultural context?
They hold centuries of history. Añil provides this deep, vibrant indigo, while grana cochinilla is this incredibly rich, intense red.
And grana cochinilla is actually extracted from tiny insects, right?
Yeah. Yes, tiny insects that live on cacti. These aren't just colors pulled from a synthetic color wheel. They are chemical compounds extracted directly from the local landscape.
That is wild.
Historically, communities in Mexico use these intense colors on their facades as a form of identity, belonging, and presence.
So the artist takes that heritage, that visual language of his culture, and amplifies the saturation until it dominates the paper.
Completely dominates it, yes.
Okay, but I have to push back a little here on the traditional use of color. If you look at standard decorative art, color is usually meant to harmonize, right?
Sure, in a traditional sense.
It's supposed to look pretty and not bother the eye. Assaulting the viewer with this much blinding intensity feels almost, I don't know, hostile compared to traditional landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
How is this extreme saturation functioning in the context of his isolation in Whittier?
It functions as a mechanism of survival.
Survival.
Yeah. In his reflective notes, the artist calls this color usage a vital affirmation. It is not decorative at all.
So it's doing active work.
Very active. When you are isolated in a totally different urban environment, surrounded by the gray and beige of a typical California sprawl, a standard accurate memory of a color will just fade over a 1,000-kilometer journey.
It dilutes.
Exactly. The memory has to be exaggerated to survive the trip intact. The extreme color functions as a psychological bridge.
It has to be louder.
It has to be a vital affirmation, or else the memory of home simply gets swallowed by the distance.
Wow. Okay. So if emotional memory is powerful enough to crank the saturation up to a fever pitch, I guess it's also powerful enough to completely corrupt the physical architecture of the painting itself.
Oh, absolutely. The geometry is completely out of its mind.
Right. If you look at the spatial proportions in the notes, it's wild. The real topography of Guanajuato is already intense.
To fully grasp the extent of the distortion, you really have to contrast it with that real topography. The actual city is an extreme environment to begin with.
Historic mining town, right? Founded in a remarkably narrow, steep ravine.
Yes, and out of pure physical necessity, the architecture had to adapt to this hostile vertical environment. The houses are built literally on top of each other, climbing up the sides of these steep hills.
So the real topography is wild enough, but the painting takes this and pushes it to a surreal extreme.
It does.
The notes describe straight lines completely disappearing. The structures lean, they bend, they warp. They take on anthropomorphic, meaning human-like qualities.
The dark arched doors look like open mouths.
And the windows look like eyes. The buildings are having this loud conversation in impossible equilibrium, basically ignoring the laws of engineering for the laws of affection.
I love that phrase, laws of affection.
It just paints a picture for me of a crowded party in a tiny apartment.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
Right, like there are so many people packed into the room that they have to lean shoulder to shoulder just to stay upright. Everyone laughing and talking over each other at once.
The architecture is no longer just a container for people. In this painting, the architecture itself has become the people.
But how does breaking all the rules of geometry affect the person looking at the art? If I see a perfectly drafted architectural blueprint, my brain knows exactly how to process it. What happens psychologically when you are presented with this kind of impossible geometry?
Well, by removing straight lines and basic north-south logic, the artist effectively disables your analytical brain.
It short-circuits it.
Exactly. When you look at a perfect literal drawing, your role is completely passive. You just sit back and verify that the technique is correct. You're grading the artist's math homework.
Admiring the copyist.
Right. But because the geometry here is impossible, you can't rely on logic to decode the image. You are forced to become an active participant.
You have to step in.
You have to navigate the piece using the fluid, distorted logic of his memory.
And these loud, living, vibrant buildings require a very specific atmosphere to contain them. Which brings us to the sky, and a subtle hidden observer in the piece.
The atmospheric management here is crucial.
Because the sky he paints isn't some soft, welcoming, pleasant blue. The notes describe it as deeply intense, almost black in places, cut by these sharp, defined white clouds.
It feels incredibly heavy, almost oppressive.
Which makes me want to challenge this a bit. If this painting is a joyous, vital affirmation of cultural pride, isn't it totally contradictory to use a heavy, threatening, near-black sky that looks like a severe storm is coming?
It seems contradictory at first, yes. But if we connect this to the bigger optical picture, that oppressive sky is doing very specific work through a principle called simultaneous contrast.
Simultaneous contrast.
Yes. When you place a heavy, dark sky directly behind brightly colored objects, it manipulates human perception. The deep darkness optically forces the bright oranges and ochres to advance forward toward the viewer.
It creates visual tension.
Immense visual tension. The architecture actually looks luminescent because of that contrast. The buildings appear to be emitting their own light.
But only because the darkness behind them is pushing them forward.
Exactly. Light cannot exist without the darkness that limits it. If he had used a happy, pale blue sky, the vibrant colors of the houses would have just washed out and flattened against the paper.
So the oppressive sky is exactly what elevates Guanajuato from just a point on a map into this glowing, mystical emblem.
It's the mechanical tool that makes the glow possible.
And amidst all that loud color and dramatic contrast, there is a moment of total quiet described in the specs. Down in the bottom right corner of the painting, by some stairs, there is a hidden figure.
The stone observer.
A pale pink stone silhouette of a woman. What is the function of tucking this quiet stone figure into such an overwhelming landscape?
Functionally, it provides a necessary psychological pause. Subjecting the viewer endlessly to incandescent colors and twisted, impossible geometries causes visual fatigue.
And the brain needs a place to rest.
Exactly. But conceptually, that stone figure does some really heavy lifting. It acts as an avatar for the artist's own diaspora.
The artist sitting quietly to observe the memory he just built out of minerals.
Yes, having traveled over 1,000 kilometers. And alternatively, it serves as a mirror for the viewer. It's an invitation for you to step into the painting and act as a silent witness to this overwhelming tide of memory.
Okay, so when you pull all these elements together, the granular mineral textures, the blinding colors, the warped anthropomorphic architecture, and the heavy sky, it culminates in a really powerful statement about what home represents in the modern world.
It really does.
The artist describes this work as a non-ironic eulogy to a culture rooted in its physical space. And in his notes, he explicitly calls this an act of Mexican nationalism.
Okay, which is a phrase we really need to handle carefully here.
Yes, let's definitely pause on that, just to be completely clear for you listening.
Mm-hmm.
Because terms like that carry heavy, real-world political implications. We are looking strictly at how the artist defines it in his own technical notes.
Right. We aren't endorsing a political platform or taking any ideological stance here. We are just impartially reporting the source material.
Exactly. The notes make a very distinct separation between his use of the phrase, and any political, institutional, or exclusionary nationalism. He isn't talking about borders or state power or anything like that.
He frames it entirely as an aesthetic and joyous nationalism. It's found in the everyday way a community chooses to build and color its homes.
Which stands in stark contrast to the current state of hyper-globalization in urban design. I mean, look at cities worldwide today. They are suffering from an accelerated standardization.
You see it everywhere.
You go to a financial district in North America, Europe, or Asia, and you see the exact same thing. Gray, corporate steel, perfectly straight lines, reflective glass.
Everything looks like everything else.
And the source notes argue that this kind of visual assimilation demands docility. The neutral palettes of modern corporate architecture erase distinct cultural identities in favor of a sterile global standard.
When the world tells you that progress looks like gray steel and straight lines, choosing to paint with unapologetic, violently saturated ochres becomes an act of refusal to disappear.
But I have to push back on the terminology a little. When we hear the word resistance, we usually think of marches and protests and policy changes.
Sure, systemic actions.
Right. So can a watercolor painting of colorful, crooked houses really hold the weight of being a genuine act of dissidence or resistance?
The source material argues that it absolutely can. This raises an important question about what resistance actually looks like.
How so?
Well, against a modern world that aggressively pushes everyone toward a neutral corporate palette, choosing to elevate the deformed, the extremely colorful, and the deeply human is a profound posture of resistance.
It's admiration transformed into pictorial matter.
Exactly. By refusing to paint buildings with straight lines or muted colors, the artist is declaring that this culture, this specific way of building a home, will not be smoothed out or standardized by global trends.
It refuses to conform.
It's an aesthetic rebellion.
Okay, so summarizing this incredible deep dive, we've seen how memory mutates spatial proportions. The artist uses heavy, granular minerals to physically anchor a memory from 1,000 kilometers away.
Utilizing the weight of the paint to fight the weight of the distance.
Yes. And emotional saturation drives him to use those feverish colors and completely distort the structural geometry, turning houses into a crowded, laughing party of architecture.
This analysis really redefines our concept of the architectural rendering.
It does. You learn that a true representation of home isn't a fixed coordinate on a map. It's highly malleable. It mutates based on nostalgia, and sometimes it requires specific crushed pigments and near-blinding colors just to survive the crushing weight of distance and time.
It has to be exaggerated to stay alive.
And that tension between literal digital reality and emotional survival leaves me with a final provocative thought that I want to pose to you, the listener, to mull over on your own.
Oh, this is a good one.
Think about how we navigate our memories in the world today. We have these incredible tools at our fingertips, like Google Street View, that offer completely sterile, literal, perfectly accurate photographic records of the streets we grew up on.
You can see exactly what the pavement looked like 10 years ago.
Exactly. You drop a pin anywhere on Earth and you get the literal reality.
Yeah.
But if we rely entirely on that digital accuracy to remember our past, are we atrophying our own emotional memory muscle?
That is a terrifying but very real possibility.
Right. So if you were forced to paint the home of your childhood today, guided strictly by affection instead of a photograph, what impossible shapes and feverish colors would the architecture of your own memory take?
A truly provocative question to consider the next time you try to picture the places that shaped you.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the architecture of memory. Keep questioning the map and keep exploring the landscape of your own history.